So on Monday we had a look at meditation. We looked at the hindrances, looked at the higher states of consciousness, at the dhyanas, and the divine abidings, the Brahma-viharas. And remember that the higher states represent transformations of consciousness, are transformations of consciousness, growth along the path to enlightenment. We're changing into highly concentrated, highly positive, skillful beings when we're in those states. But although this state of the path is indispensable, it really is indispensable, this state of the path, this state of samadhi, it's not a permanent attainment. It can be lost and gained, and lost and gained. You know, we go up and down, we go in and out. To really establish ourselves on the path, definitively, as it were, we need to move to wisdom, prajna. We need to develop wisdom, we need to train in wisdom. So that's the topic of the talk this morning, the training in wisdom. Now, we don't have to wait until we've fully perfected samadhi to train in wisdom. We don't have to wait until we can, you know, dwell in the fourth dhyana for days at a time before we turn to wisdom. There are different levels of wisdom in Buddhist tradition, and we train in those levels of wisdom alongside our practice of ethics and meditation. If you like, wisdom in the full sense, wisdom proper, is seeing things as they really are. But there's a lead up to that. In time, if we're practicing wisdom, developing wisdom, alongside practicing ethics and meditation, eventually wisdom will be perfected. We will have this insight, this definitive insight into the nature of things. Remember the Buddha's teaching, I'll repeat it again, great is the fruit, great is the result of meditation when set round with ethics, with the basis of ethics. Great is the fruit, great is the result of wisdom when set round with meditation, when it's on the basis of meditation. So really, in a way, what we're saying here is that we move along on all fronts, ethics, meditation and wisdom. We're working on them all at the same time. But for the higher stages to really develop in their fullness, we need to perfect the stage before. So if we want the meditation to be really deep and fruitful, we really need to perfect our ethics. If we want wisdom to be the real thing, we need to perfect our meditation. So according to Buddhist tradition, there are three kinds of prajna, three kinds of wisdom. First of all, there's the wisdom that comes through learning. Secondly, there's the wisdom that comes through reflection. And thirdly, there's the wisdom that comes from meditation, or the wisdom which is a direct experience, a living experience. Wisdom proper, if you like. So first of all, let's look at the wisdom that comes through learning. What this means is that we need to understand the basic Buddhist teachings. We need to know clearly what the Buddha has taught. You know, what he says about the wheel of life, what he says about the path, what he says about the goal. This doesn't mean that we have to become a kind of Buddhist scholastic or a Buddhist academic or go to the University of Buddhist Studies or something like that and get, you know, very, very complicated, you know, thought processes going on and all the rest of it and have a, you know, a degree in Buddhist philosophy. It doesn't mean that. Some people might do that, but we don't, you know, that's not what we have to do. What we need to do is to have a handle on basic Buddhism. We need to have a handle on basic Buddhism. You know, we just need to be clear about basic Buddhism, the basic teachings like morality, meditation and wisdom, the sort of things that we're exploring over this week. If we're particularly concerned with developing insight, then we need to have a particularly good handle and understanding of what in Buddhism is called the true nature of existence. We need to be very clear about impermanence and satisfactoriness and no fixed self, no unchanging self. I'm going to go into these a bit later, these three things. So it's very important to be clear, to develop what's known in Buddhism as right view, which is the first stage of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It's really important to have a clear understanding of the Buddha's teaching. We won't get very far if we're vague and confused. This is really important. I mean, in what's called spiritual life, there can be so much sort of wooliness and vagueness and confusion and spaced outness. Well, in Buddhist tradition, it's not like that. Clear thinking is regarded as very, very important. Clear understanding. So this means study of the Dharma is very important. Which again, it's not academic study by any means. Reading the books on basic Buddhism, things like Sangharakshita's talks on the Eightfold Path and on A Guide to the Buddhist Path. Those are really useful. I mean, you really get the basics from those. Sometimes people ask me, how do I get a good grasp of the basics? Well, I'd say read Sangharakshita's book on the Eightfold Path, the Bodhisattva Ideal, and A Guide to the Buddhist Path. If you know those, you've got hold of the trunk of Buddhism. And if you can get to a Buddhist study group, well, so much the better. So that you can clarify your ideas. But we really do need to get to have a very clear understanding of what the path is all about. We need to have a clear understanding of our situation, of the goal that is a liberation from that situation, and a very clear idea about the path. One of Sangharakshita's teachers, who was a very famous Hindu teacher late 1940s, early 50s, named Ram Dass, Swami Ram Dass. When Bhante stayed with him, he asked him, why do so many people start out in the spiritual life and so few people gain enlightenment or realisation? And Ram Dass said, because they have no clear idea of where they're going and no clear idea of how to get there. So a very pithy answer, which had quite a strong effect on Sangharakshita. It sort of made him think that, well, it's really important not to be muddled in your approach to spiritual life. So you need to know where you're going, you need to know how to get there. You also need to know what you're moving away from. The Buddha is not vague about spiritual practice. It's very clear. Clarity is a basis for action. So the wisdom that comes through learning is just getting a clear idea of what the Buddha's teachings really are. Secondly, there's the wisdom that comes through reflection. So it's not enough to understand clearly what the teaching says. You need to think about it. You need to reflect on it. You need to contemplate it. You even need to question it in the sense of trying to get to its deeper meaning. Not question it in a sort of cynical fashion, but question it to try and see what it deeply means. Buddhism does not encourage blind belief. You need to investigate Buddhism and understand it much more deeply and see it against your experience, weigh it against your experience and your previous understanding. You need to learn to think, in other words, if you're following a Buddhist life. You need to learn to think, not in a narrowly intellectual fashion, in a clever kind of way. The kind of thinking we're talking about here includes emotion and feeling. Remember, we're training in wisdom alongside the trainings in ethics and meditation. It's integrated thought that we need to bring to bear on the teaching. Creative thought. There's a great poem by D.H. Lawrence which seems to naturally arise here. This is his poem called Thought, where he describes what real thinking is. Thought. Thought. I love thought. But not the jiggling and twisting of already existent ideas. I despise that self-important game. Thought is the welling up of unknown life into consciousness. Thought is the testing of statements on the touchstone of the conscience. Thought is gazing onto the face of life and reading what can be read. Thought is pondering over experience and coming to a conclusion. Thought is not a trick or an exercise or a set of dodges. Thought is a man in his wholeness wholly attending. Thought is a man in his wholeness wholly attending. That's the kind of thought that you need to bring to bear on your understanding of Buddhist ideas, you know, bringing the all of yourself to bear on penetrating its meaning. And you can see how close this is to meditation. Thirdly, there's the wisdom that comes through meditation, or rather the wisdom that becomes a direct, a living experience. Here we bring our full attention arising from the depths of meditation, concentrated positive attention to our understanding and to what we're thinking about. We bring that to it, and this transforms our understanding into direct experience. For example, impermanence moves from being an idea to becoming an actual living experience of change, of arising and passing away. An actual direct taste of that. It's not a theory anymore. It's not even something that you've had very important reflections about. It's gone right into your being because your meditation has made you extraordinarily receptive in relation to it. So when you drop that notion into your consciousness, it brings about a complete transformation in the light of that truth. And of course, this can only happen if our ethics, our behaviour has been purified, and if our mind and heart has been developed in meditation. And when this starts to happen, it really happens, it never leaves us. It's no longer an idea. It's a living reality all the time. And that's a very, very different thing. It's said, in fact, I mean, just to show how sort of mysterious it is, when you penetrate impermanence, you enter a doorway to liberation called the signless. The signless. You know, there are no kind of signs anymore, no sort of distinct things. There's just this flow of change. Well, that's just my words. I mean, what it is, obviously, is beyond words in the end, but it gives you some idea of, you know, where you're heading when insight into impermanence becomes a living experience. So these are the three kinds, the three levels of wisdom. But what about the content of what is seen? I mean, you're already getting some idea of that, obviously. And the Buddha and Buddhist tradition generally is very rich, actually, in pointing to the content of what's seen. And I say pointing to it for obvious reasons, because the actual experience of wisdom is said to be beyond words, beyond thought. It can't be reduced to an idea. It can't be reduced to a set of notions. But thankfully, the Buddha gave us doorways into the wordless. He gave us words, ideas to work with. And it's a wonderful saying by a later Buddhist master, which describes this whole process of training in wisdom. It goes, "We use words to go beyond words so as to attain the pure wordless essence." So I'm going to read now three very famous verses from the Dhammapada that describe what is seen when we develop prajna in its fullness, when we see things as they are. So these verses go. They're from the chapter on the way, the path. "All conditioned things are impermanent. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity." So these verses are very, very famous indeed, and they're central to all Buddhist traditions and all schools of Buddhism. And they describe what are known as the three lakshanas, the three marks of existence, the three marks of life, if you like. Life is characterized by these three essential marks or signs: impermanence, suffering or pain, and absence of selfhood. When you really see these marks, you wake up, you become enlightened, you're liberated, you're free. So let's go through these. All conditioned things are impermanent. Sabbe sankhara anicca. You want the Pali, famous Pali word. All conditioned things are impermanent. So we've already, you know, referred to impermanence a little. This verse, this line is pointing to the universality of impermanence. Everywhere we look, inside ourselves, outside of ourselves, there is just impermanence. Things are arising and they're passing away. There is nothing permanent anywhere. Nothing lasts forever. Galaxies come and go. Worlds come and go. Empires come and go. You know, they seem so fixed, but they come and go. Great men come and go. And of course we see it in the seasons, you know, so vividly. You know, we're in summer, and you know, this summer seemed to be very changeable these days, very wet and then hot and then wet. The other day somebody was saying to me it seemed to sort of change almost every minute. It was hot and then it was wet. It was hot and then it was wet. It was bright and then it was dark. Wonderful conditions the British have, or people who live in Britain have, for contemplating impermanence. We really shouldn't complain about the weather. But summer, wet or hot, becomes autumn. The leaves will start to fade and fall. You know, already if you go up the garden, you see the red, you know, berries on the rowan trees. You know, it's the sign that even here in the midst of summer, autumn is sort of calling out. Autumn becomes winter. Everything, if you come here in winter, it's a very different scene. That lush and abundant garden is completely bare and denuded. And yeah, winter becomes spring, and so on. And tradition tells us, contemplate the seasons to really tune into impermanence, and contemplate the course of a day. The sun rises and then the sun sets. You know, throughout the day you can contemplate this impermanence. There's just constant change, constant arising and passing. A constant sort of moving on. Very, very poignant, this, when you contemplate it. You just look at the summer flowers. I mean, I always find this. I'm always struck by this. You know, the fully opened rose. And there's some fantastic roses in that alleyway. And I was looking at one last night. Beautiful, full pink rose. But it was already fading. You know, as soon as it reaches fullness, it's passing away. It's as soon as it's at its peak, it's beginning to pass out of existence. It's already fading. There's this incredible coming together, you know, of things emerging as this beauty, but then it's just fading. As soon as it emerges, it fades. It passes away. As soon as it reaches its peak, it's rotting. Even that great saying of Heidegger's. Great German philosopher, being never fully flowers. I think that's a wonderful little maxim, poetic way of putting it. Presence is always becoming absence. I was reading yesterday something that Vidyavadra wrote. He's got a very good website, if you're interested, on the great Zen master Dogen. And he does this wonderful meditation on Dogen's notions of presence and absence. In relation to his ordinary experience, and it was a very poignant experience of bereavement, and it's well worth reading for this sense of things arising and passing, arising and passing. So this impermanence is everywhere. It's woven into life. It's life itself. You know, in our relationships, we meet, we come together. Significant meetings sometimes. Maybe we're together for a long time, maybe for a short time. We meet in love and affection. But contained in every meeting is parting. If there is meeting, there must be parting. There can't be meeting forever. It's impossible. In every meeting there is parting. Pay attention. Whenever there's a meeting, there's a parting. Meetings always end in parting, sooner or later. It doesn't matter how spiritually developed we are. Whoever meets must part. And it's a very poignant moment at the end of the Buddha's life, where Ananda, his very faithful friend and attendant and companion for more than 20 years, was just, as the Buddha was there, dying, passing away, Ananda just broke down. And Ananda was a very developed man. He was a highly developed individual. But it was all too much. And he was weeping, reflecting, and even saying that the master, my teacher, is about to pass away. He who is so kind, so compassionate, he's about to pass. And I haven't sort of attained, you know, the full attainment. And it's very poignant. The Buddha calls Ananda to him, even though he's dying. And he just says very, very tenderly, Ananda, haven't I always said that it's impossible for what has been brought together, what comes together, it's impossible for that to stay like that. That must break up. Whatever you love, whoever you love, the way they come together, even that must end. It must pass. It can't be otherwise. This is the way of things. Things come together only to pass. So even here, even in this, you know, even with this level of attainment, you get this insight, having to be taught. All conditioned things are impermanent. Conditioned, the word here is sankhara or samskara. And it simply means that which is put together, that which is constructed, that which is made up of parts, that which is made up of causes and conditions. Well, if it's made up of things, it must break up. If it's put together, the put together must break up, must break down. It will fall apart. From our mind and body are put together, well, our mind and body will break up. To the cosmos, that's put together, that will break up. And everything in between, and everybody in between. There is just this arising and passing. So we need to learn to see this, to really look at this and pay attention to this. We need to bring this reflection, all conditioned things are impermanent, into our daily life. And notice it, pay attention to change. You know, really pay attention to falling petals, to falling leaves. Notice that and think all conditioned things are impermanent. Everything is like this. Pay attention to the changes in the body. That's teaching you that everything is impermanent. Notice the way the mind is always moving. That's impermanence, where mind is, thoughts are arising and passing. Pay attention to the breath coming and going. The breath is so extraordinarily impermanent, isn't it? That continuous movement of change, arising and passing, arising and passing. Pay attention to meetings and partings. Pay attention to life and death. Now, obviously, we need to do this with the right attitude. This is really important. On the basis of a very well-developed mind, developed in meditation, with a very positive attitude, an attitude generated through awareness and loving kindness. So that, you know, we really see it in the right way, that we're not depressed by it, that we're not, you know, we don't sort of end up with the sort of view where nothing matters. That's not, if you're getting that, you're not seeing impermanence as it is. So you need to see it with all the training that's developed through meditation. Now, in the translation we used, it says, when one sees this with insight. This is a translation of the Pali word panya, prajna, also translated as wisdom. So insight, seeing, are good words to describe the direct experience of insight. This is what it seems the dawning of wisdom is like, when we see in a direct, unmediated way. There's no need for words and ideas. You're just seeing it as it is. And of course, it's it's got all sorts of connotations of like waking up from sleep, dream, blindness. You're seeing things as they actually are. So it's a good way of describing wisdom, using the language of seeing. But it does have its limitations. When wisdom dawns, it's not actually that you are looking at something over there called impermanence. You're not separated off, considering impermanence, from a great height or something like that. The realization of impermanence is in you and around you. It's, as it were, burned into your being. It pervades and perfumes all experience. The wisdom of impermanence becomes as familiar to you as breathing. It's felt on the pulses, as Keats's phrase has it. It might dawn slowly. It might be a slow dawning of this realization, or very dramatically, as when Milarepa sees the pot breaking and he sees that everything is impermanence, and this pot is his teacher teaching him impermanence, as we saw yesterday. When this realization dawns, the effect, as the verse has it, is to make one weary of suffering. Weary of suffering. The word for weary in Pali is nibbida, which literally means to turn away from. That's another alternative translation. You turn away from suffering when you see impermanence with insight. We suffer so much because we regard the impermanent as permanent. That's a lot of the reason why we suffer. However much we might tell ourselves that all is impermanent, emotionally, we still believe that things and we ourselves are permanent. And we build a life thinking, believing, feeling that it is lasting. And it's going to stay like this forever. And we form not just connections, but deep attachments and clingings. And our happiness becomes very dependent on these things which we think are permanent. Our happiness becomes very dependent on those things. And when that person goes, or these things go, as they will, we experience pain, suffering, grief, sorrow. When you see impermanence, you become weary of this. You become, tired of this life of attaching yourself to things which are in reality impermanent. Now, it's not that we should stop connecting. It's not that we should stop loving and stop living. But we need, whatever we do, however we love, however we live, we need to do so in full awareness of the truth of impermanence. And of course, this means that we'll love and live better, more truthfully, when we really take the truth of impermanence in, and when we live by impermanence. You can see an illustration of that with the story of the Buddha and Ananda. Ananda is very, very upset at the prospect of the Buddha's passing. The Buddha's response is so compassionate, because he knows that this is the way of things. But that means that results in great kindness and sensitivity to Ananda, and he encourages him in his spiritual path. When we realise the truth of impermanence, we realise that we can transform ourselves. As the text says, seeing this is the way to purity. If we see impermanence with the eye of wisdom, this is the way to purity. In other words, we don't get stuck, caught up in impurity, in states like greed, craving, anger, confusion, and so on. They just don't stick. We've seen through them. We've just seen through all of that. So they don't stick anymore. And that's the way to purity. In fact, it's said when you really, fully realise impermanence, you enter the stream. You enter the stream that can only flow to nirvana or enlightenment. You become irreversible in your spiritual development. When you really see it, when you're really, you've deeply taken it in, there's no going back. Because you realise that, your potential for unlimited change. You've got a one-way ticket to nirvana. There's no going back. So paradoxically, perhaps, when you realise the truth of impermanence, you gain, as it were, some permanence. It means when you see impermanence that the Dharma, that reality, that the truth, is firmly fixed within you. So if we want something permanent, that's okay to desire permanence. If we want something really reliable, paradoxically, that's going to come when you wake up to impermanence, when you live by that. You can really rely on impermanence. I'll make an interesting advertising slogan. So let's go to the next verse. All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. Painful is the translation of the word dukkha, which can also be translated as suffering or as unsatisfactoriness. And this phrase, all conditioned things are painful, can be a real stumbling block for some people getting involved with Buddhism. You often you say, well, Buddhism is so pessimistic because it says all conditioned things are suffering. Buddhism is, thinks that suffering is more real than happiness because it says that all conditioned things are suffering. Buddhism is saying that pleasure is bad, enjoyment is bad and unreal, and so on and so on. But these are all misconceptions, all false views about Buddhism. The Buddha is definitely not saying that suffering is real or more real, and that being miserable is a sign of spiritual progress. It doesn't mean, if you see somebody who's getting more and more miserable, they're on the path, they're really serious practitioners. No, 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 no. Actually, the contrary is true. As you let go of attachments, as you see more deeply, as you spiritually unfold, as consciousness expands, you're going to experience greater joy and happiness. You're not inured to suffering and you're not insensitive to the suffering of others. But as you go on, you're just feeling greater freedom and greater happiness. I remember Sangharakshita saying that Christian missionaries, when they were in Ceylon, thought, great, we can really have a good go at Buddhism because it teaches dukkha, the first noble truth, suffering. And Buddhism is all about, the joy of being, reborn in Jesus Christ. And they'd go and talk to Buddhists and they'd say, your teaching says that all things are suffering. And the Sri Lankans, the Sinhalese, yes, everything is suffering. And just be smiling and laughing and really, sort of joyful. And they couldn't quite put that together, apparently, in their minds, the Christian missionaries, because they didn't understand what the Buddha really taught. So the reason why the Buddha points to suffering is for practical reasons. We have a very strong human tendency, probably for good reason, but it's still entraps us. We have a strong human tendency to avoid looking at the faults within life. We like to paper over the cracks, to ignore the difficult stuff that needs attention, that's telling us something about life in general, and our life in particular. It's telling us some, there's some information that unsatisfactoriness and suffering and the difficult things and the painful things, it's actually telling us something which we don't want to look at. It's telling us something about life. We don't want to look at it because we don't want to change ourselves. We don't want to transform ourselves. So it's very practical, this point. It's not really a metaphysical point. It's just a practical point. Pay attention to painfulness, to unsatisfactoriness. So the Buddha distinguishes three kinds of suffering that we need to pay attention to. First of all, the suffering of suffering. Secondly, the suffering of change. And thirdly, the suffering of conditioned existence. So let's look at these. So first of all, the suffering of suffering. Suffering is painful. It happens. And we're in a world, or we're in a mode of being, where suffering occurs. That's just a fact. We've got the kind of psychophysical organism, and we're in a world where suffering happens. We get ill, we get injured, and so on and so forth. It happens. And it's no use complaining or hand-wringing. We need to just wake up to it. We need to recognise that we're in a world where change happens, where things break up and move on, and that can bring about pain. And that's painful. I mean, I just noticed it in myself. I thought, oh, I'm getting warm. I put the shorts on. And as soon as I put the shorts on, the sun went in. I thought, come on. And I thought, suffering of conditioned existence. You are in a world where this happens. And you are a being who responds to that as though it's painful. Suffering of suffering. So we need to wise up to that, you know, and develop some acceptance, some patience, and forbearance in relation to that, instead of sort of complaining about it all the time. Secondly, there's the suffering of change. We've already seen that life is change. Well, suffering is bound up with that very often. So much suffering comes about through loss, through ending, through changing circumstances. And there is a level of our being that is dimly aware of that change. Sangharakshita calls this sometimes potential suffering, the suffering of potential. Things are okay now, but when things change, there'll be suffering. And we are often very, you know, there is some awareness of that at the periphery of our consciousness. And there's a lot of anxiety, I think, in relation to that. A lot of anxiety and depression, a lot of our sort of modern diseases, I think, are because people are just keeping this at bay. You know, and we're living in a world which is trying to pretend through advertising and all the rest of it that it's not happening. Meanwhile, pumping out through the media horror stories that the world is going to end very soon because of environmental catastrophe, terrorism, war, murder and all the rest of it. And yet we're told everything's all right. You know, no wonder we're so messed up. Let's change this world. Anyway... But there's a real anxiety in relation to this thing, because we know that it's going to fall apart. We know that things are going to change. And that's unsettling and painful. But very often we don't really address this. We try to pretend that it's okay. We don't really look at it. We keep papering over the cracks, and then that paper tears. So occasionally, sometimes, something happens and we just can't ignore the suffering of change. You know, we just can't, you know, it's just right in our face. And we see this with bereavement or great catastrophe. People for a while begin to question themselves and what life is for. You know, when the tsunami happened and things like that. For a while, we've got to do something about this or whatever it is. But not for very long. Very often, and not thoroughly enough. We won't go to the root of the problem. I mean, the great Burmese meditation master, forest master Ajahn Mun, who lived in the early 20th century, you know, he'd say to his monks who were suffering from sickness or, you know, real, you know, very strong sense of the suffering of change, just sit and go right to the root of the problem. Find the root of the issue, which is your involvement in conditioned existence. So we need to pay attention to the suffering that comes through change. Thirdly, there's the suffering of conditioned existence. So Sangharakshita is called this existential suffering. This is the suffering that's inherent in being a limited, a conditioned being, an unenlightened being. There's something within us that actually wants to unfold and expand towards enlightenment. We might have everything we need and more. Everything's going well. But we experience just this deep, profound dissatisfaction with it all. Well, that's our Buddha potential making itself felt, saying, come on, I want to break out of this. This is not enough. This is not satisfying. Even though everything's fine. You know, any of your friends might be, you know, what's the problem? Why are you so dissatisfied? You know, they can't understand it. It's because you want something which is much bigger and much deeper and much richer than all this. And this, of course, was the Buddha's own experience before his enlightenment. You know, he was born into royalty. He had great wealth, great comfort, great power, great privilege. But he was deeply dissatisfied and deeply troubled by the facts of illness and old age and death, you know, and meaning. You know, what's the point? You know, when you know, life just ends in death. You know, what is this life for? And there was this very deep longing for spiritual spiritual freedom. And there are some very beautiful descriptions in some of the lives of the Buddha. There's one in particular by a Buddhist poet named Ashvaghosha, which describes him sitting at the edge of the jungle when he was a young man and he hadn't left home at that point. And he's sitting and he's watching. It almost becomes sort of visionary, almost sort of Bruegel-like, the description. He's watching a ploughman plough the field, and he notices the old, weathered ploughman very vividly described, and the toil of this, and the ox pulling the plough, and how, you know, the toil of that, and the ground being broken, and the worms and the insects being broken, and all the animals being disturbed. And it's like a sort of vision of the wheel of life, the toil of existence itself. And he, you know, just has this life is one of, you know, toil and suffering. And it's so unsatisfactory. And out of this, a very deep longing, like a sort of gasp, you know, when will an escape, a liberation from this be realised? When will it be known? When will it be seen? And it said that out of that state of deep longing arising out of this, you know, profound dissatisfaction, the higher meditation arose, and this faith arose to follow the path to enlightenment. And this is something to sort of, you know, in a way cultivate, you know, this sort of seeing through existence, seeing it as, you know, really unsatisfactory, and developing a deep longing and love for the spiritual freedom. You know, the mantra we do at the end of the puja, the Padmasambhava mantra, the slow one. Well, that is said to be, you know, you chant that with great longing that's sort of arising from, well, you know, it's all very unsatisfactory, you know. Well, I certainly feel that, you know, myself, I am unsatisfactory. And this deep longing to move towards the satisfaction of liberation. So we need to pay attention to this suffering of conditioned existence. You know, when it arises, notice it. Yes, this is because I'm a limited being. You know, I'm full of limitations. And that feeling of being cramped, well, that's your potential for enlightenment, for liberation, making itself felt, pressing upon you. It's the green shoot of potential, you know, pushing up and making you aware of your limitations. And again, the verse says, when we see the truth of suffering with insight, with wisdom, we become weary of suffering. And this sounds strange, of course. When we see suffering, we become weary of suffering. But the point is, when we really look into suffering in the way I've described, we turn away from the needless suffering we inflict upon ourselves and others. We see much more clearly the suffering we create through our craving and attachment and aversion and ill will and stupidity. And we enter the path of purity, the path of unfolding and pure, skillful states, expanding states, moving towards enlightenment. And enlightenment is a state of no more suffering. Nirvana, Bodhi, is a state where there is no more pain. It's the liberation from all suffering. Nirvanam paramam sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. says the Buddha. And later Buddhism, picking up on that, speaks of nirvana as the Mahasukha, the great bliss. So this supreme bliss, this great bliss, this supreme happiness, this great happiness, is actually rather mysterious in a way. It's a bliss, a happiness that arises when grasping at self and other has ended. When there's no longer any attachment to self and other. When you've seen through that false distinction between self and other. And you're not dependent on anything. And this bliss is not dependent on anything. It's unconditioned bliss. It's not supported by anything, so it never goes away. It's a bliss, a happiness, that continuously wells and grows and expands and pours forth as love and compassion for all beings who suffer the limitations of conditioned existence. So this great bliss that you're experiencing is expressed in a continuous stream of creativity for others, to benefit of others. And the Buddha himself is the supreme example of this, the bliss of enlightenment expressed in unstinting energy and generosity. Just this continuous communicating of his teaching and befriending of those who would come to him. Doesn't mean, of course, that the Buddha was exempt from physical pain and trouble. Enlightenment doesn't free you from physical pain and suffering, not at all. But you are free of the suffering of change and the suffering of conditioned existence, because they're very much to do with your attitudes to things. But physical pain you still experience, and you see this. Physical pain you no longer experience. And you see this illustrated very powerfully in the Buddha's own life. He lived till the venerable age of 80. And throughout his life, after his enlightenment, he just continued teaching, and that carried on to his last days. He took a great long teaching tour in his 80th year, walking, spending time with his disciples. In fact, he was teaching until his last breath. And he had very severe illness of various kinds. We know that he must have had terrible dysentery, which is a very serious illness, terrible stomach pains, terrible back pain that the Buddha suffered from, very severe. But it's very interesting that on a retreat, the rainy season retreat, he was really in terrible pain, and he worked with it, he dwelt with it, he didn't say anything about it. Ananda observed it, the faithful Ananda, and was very disturbed by it. And afterwards, when the Buddha had sort of really dealt with it, and sort of where it says that he kind of mastered it so he could, out of compassion, go and teach the Dharma to his disciples, Ananda asked him about what was happening. And the Buddha said that he was in constant pain. Constant pain, physical pain. But his mind was not affected. His mind was always clear, always luminously aware. That was not in any way affected by the physical pain. And he could, if he wanted, withdraw from the physical pain into profound meditation, into the signless samadhi. But when he was just functioning, walking around, he was always in pain, but it didn't make any difference to his mindfulness and awareness, and no doubt to his love and compassion. So in other words, and really, this is what we should aim our practice towards, that when we're in these sorts of states of physical pain, physical illness, even when we're facing our own death, there's no difference to the luminosity of our mind, to the luminosity of our consciousness, to our awareness and our loving kindness for others. And as I say, the Buddha was teaching right to the end, right to his last breath. So let's go to the next verse, the third of these verses on the three marks. All things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. So all things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. The term unchanging selfhood is the translation of the Pali anatar, anatman in Sanskrit, which literally means not self or no self. So all things whatsoever are without selfhood, all things sabbe dhamma. This means that not only in the world, in samsara, in unenlightenment, the wheel of life, is there no self, but also in nirvana, the state of Buddhahood, there is no self. There's no essence, any core, any self, any soul in anything. Again, this term not self is one of those terms which can lead to a great deal of misunderstanding. People can sometimes think, indeed do think, and get into terrible states because of it, that Buddhist practice means sort of blanking yourself out. That Buddhist practice is sort of progressive alienation. You know, enlightenment is about disappearing into some sort of blank void where you're not there. And, you know, you should just sort of be completely spaced out and presumably wandering around like a zombie, you know, like this, you know, the night of the living dead, you know. And, you know, I have actually met people who've had that kind of misunderstanding of Buddhism, coming in like, you know, Mr. Zombie, thinking that they've attained not self. It's very sad. There's this strange sort of arrogance that goes with it, which is rather weird. But anyway, this is a complete misunderstanding. The teaching of not self is an extension of the teaching of impermanence. It's not that people and things change, as if there's something that goes through a change. When you look deeply, there is no core, no essence to anything. There's just a flow of causes and conditions giving rise to further causes and conditions. And nowhere in that is there a fixed and permanent self or essence. Yeah? Sometimes this I use the word saying that in Buddhism there's no soul, an atman. And that can people can misinterpret that to think that there's no kind of inner life. Well, that's not the case. It's just that the inner life, if you like the soul, is dynamic and changing, and nowhere is there anything fixed and unchanging. That's the point. All is becoming. Remember in the opening talk, we just saw that everything is a flow of becoming, inside and outside. So this is the central Buddhist teaching of what's called Pratitya Samuppada, dependent origination, or conditioned co-production, or dependent arising. Everything is just this flow of conditions giving rise to further conditions, and there's nothing outside of that. In later Buddhism, they push this even further and call it emptiness, because everything is empty of a fixed self or substance. It's not that there's nothing there. Obviously, we're here in the room, vividly present to one another. It's not that, you know, we're not here. But if we were to look and to analyse closely what was going on, we'd find that there's just nothing fixed and unchanging here. You know, that self and other are a flow, we're flowing into each other. Once again, the verse says, when we see this with insight, with wisdom, we become weary of suffering. So how do we see this with insight? How do we see this with insight? Well, there are many, many reflections and meditation to see not self. And they're quite heady. And it's no wonder that Westerners have, you know, turned into a bit zombie-like in relation to it. But back in the 1970s, Sangharakshita opened up a completely different way of approaching this topic. He picked up on a translation of the word for wisdom, prajna, a bit of a mouthful of a translation. It was an Austrian scholar who coined it. Analytical appreciative discrimination. But what Sangharakshita picked up on was this word appreciative. Appreciative. And he started to talk about prajna, wisdom, as aesthetic appreciation. Aesthetic appreciation. And what he means by aesthetic appreciation, that you see other people, the world, the things in it, as they are in themselves. Not in terms of how you can use them. Not in terms of utility and use, which is bound up with our craving and grasping, and which is seeing them as very fixed and separate entities. But you see them as they are in themselves. You see them as beautiful. As beautiful. And he said that practicing the metta bhavana is a means of attaining this, of achieving this. When you really see others with metta, with loving kindness, you see them as they are in themselves. You're not trying to get anything from them. You're not trying to get anything back. You're seeing them as they are in themselves. And you see their beauty, especially their spiritual beauty. You see their spiritual potential. You see that they're not fixed, that they can't be defined or fixed or even conceived. You can get a sort of glimpse of this sometimes in the metta. If you really get into it, you're dwelling on somebody. And it's as if you're looking at them as a great painter would paint a portrait. You know, there's a fantastic painting in the Courtauld Gallery by Cézanne of an old boy with a pipe, an old man with a pipe. Just a bloke, you know, he used to see down in the local bar. And I remember a friend of mine taking me to see that painting. He said, that painting was painted with metta. That's what you need to do in the metta bhavana. That's how you need to see people. This old man with a pipe is seen with the eye of beauty. And I was looking at some Rembrandt portraits the other day. I mean, just extraordinary. I mean, they're seen with love. And the more you look at them, the more you realise, my goodness, a living being is utterly inconceivable. You know, you can't name them, you can't label them, you can't define them. And of course, you know, when you go and look at great paintings like that, you start seeing the people you're with very, very differently. So when you do the metta bhavana, try sometimes doing the practice. Don't try to sort of generate thoughts of maybe happy, maybe well, maybe happy. Pause. Visualise. Imagine. Feel the presence of the other person. And just have them in mind. And look. Look as if, you know, you were Rembrandt or Cézanne or, you know, whoever. But look. Look at them as they are. Stripped of all your desires, stripped of all your ill will, your indifference, as they are in themselves, and you know, lo and behold, you know, real loving kindness and real wisdom will actually arise in that moment in time. Because when you see like that, how can you fix another person, another being? How can you fix anyone or anything? It's completely impossible. Life is so full and rich and dynamic. And, well, when you see like that, you become weary of suffering. The suffering that's everywhere, not just your suffering. You've left, you know, you're not too bothered about that. Actually, what you're really concerned about is the suffering everywhere. The suffering that comes when people fix and define life and fix it and reduce life and hold life down and hold themselves and other people down. And you live to dispel that. You live to want to dispel that. You enter the way of what's called the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva in Buddhism is the being dedicated to enlightenment, but dedicated enlightenment with and for all beings. He or she wants everyone to have that enlightenment. And there's a great release of energy when you sing like that. Tremendous release of energy. A great release of love. And it's said that, you know, when you become a proper bodhisattva, when you're really seeing like this, well, your activity of bringing the Dharma to everyone and working for the Dharma and, you know, working to help being is lila, play. It's playful. You enjoy it. It's fun. Other people might think you're working, you know, really, really hard, doing really difficult things. But for you, it's a laugh. You know, it's great fun because you're in touch, you know, with the real nature of life. You're in touch with this ever-changing nature of life, the beauty of life, even in the midst of great ugliness and suffering. You're liberated into endless generosity and spontaneous activity. There's a wonderful Zen teaching that describes this, called the ox herding pictures. And these ox herding pictures describe the path to enlightenment. And the last one is called entering the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. You know, you've got on this great journey of developing yourself, of seeing into the nature of things, but the last stage is a picture of this old grizzled character who's quite bulky, you know, just walking along the path by a flowering tree, meeting people, very relaxed, very rich, very happy, and it's a picture of the seasoned, playful bodhisattva. And it says things like, without troubling himself to perform miracles, suddenly dead trees burst into bloom. You know, that's the effect you start having on people when you're living like this. You know, you're not trying to do any miracles, but your presence and your teaching and your communication with people makes them just burst into bloom. In other words, they wake up, their spiritual potential wakes up. And you're very flexible and very responsive. It says, you know, he speaks Mongolian, he speaks Chinese, you know, can talk to anybody and connect with them. That's what we're aiming for. So anyway, tomorrow we'll explore this a bit more, because obviously that state is a state of great freedom, enormous freedom when you're operating like that. And tomorrow we'll look at the last stage of the path, the stage of liberation, which is the effect of the trainings in morality, meditation, and wisdom.